Okay, we are at another minor prophet. We are making some good progress, or not, depends on what you think fast is. We have made it through, Jonah, Micah, Haggai, and now we're in Habakkuk. You can turn to Habakkuk. I'm going to tell you now because it might take you a while to find it. I understand that's how it often is with these minor prophets. But we are in the book of Habakkuk. And just to, I think it might be helpful for us, we're on our fourth out of 12, to take a moment to look back and just connect some dots. The first one chronologically would be Jonah. Jonah's from the northern kingdom. If you remember, Israel, right after Solomon's reign, splits in half. And we have the northern kingdom, and they do not have Davidic kings. And then we have the southern kingdom, and they do have Davidic kings, meaning that they have kings that come from David. The promise is still standing. Jonah's from the north, and we saw that he is sent to Assyria, to Nineveh, and he preaches, and they repent. And then about 100 years later, they stop repenting, and the northern kingdom is destroyed by Assyria. The next book we covered was Micah. That happens around the time when the northern kingdom was in threat of being destroyed, but Micah's preaching in the south. Then we went a lot in history past Babylon coming in and destroying the southern kingdom, past Persia destroying Babylon, and we went all the way to Israel returning to the land at the end. So just to give you kind of a broad scheme of this time period, we have the northern and southern kingdom, then we have the northern kingdom destroyed, then we have the southern kingdom exiled, we have a period of exile, and then we have what we call the post-exilic period, which is when the people return to the land. So where does Habakkuk fit into all of this? He is a southern prophet. However, he preaches at a time where the north has already been destroyed. So we are near the end. It's essentially where Habakkuk is. If you want to view Habakkuk in a light, he's essentially looking back on a destroyed northern kingdom and looking forward to an exiled southern kingdom. So as we get into the text, I'd like to, first off, I said I was going to mention this. This, just a kingdom-minded moment. I'd like to bring to your attention that Greenbrier Christian, where I teach, just sent, I think, 20-ish students and four teachers to the Dominican Republic on a missions trip for a whole week. So if you'll just keep that in your prayers. You know, at our church, we like to be kingdom-minded. It's not just our missionaries, but missionaries in general. So I wanted to remember to say that. If you'll be keeping them in your prayers, I know I will. Let's pray for the text, and then we'll get started. Lord, thank you so much for this text. I pray that Habakkuk would teach us how to ask you questions and not understand your plan while maintaining faithfulness and love to you. In your name I pray. Amen. So, the book of Habakkuk is kind of an interesting one because it is controversial. And why do I say that? Well, because there's a range of opinions throughout church history. If you went back to the 700s and you asked some of the Latin-speaking people, Jerome specifically, they would say, what an impertinent, foul-mouthed, and rude prophet we have here. And then if you go more towards the 1500s and you ask John Calvin, he would say, you know, it was understandable, but certainly not ideal. And then when you go to the modern day, people are saying, you know, maybe Habakkuk has something to teach us. And so there's a large range. We're going to see that some of the things that Habakkuk says to God may feel a little uncomfortable. Our question today is, how do you respond when you look at the world and it is out of order? And second, how do you respond when you look at the world and you pray and God seems silent? Those are the two questions we're going to wrestle with. The structure of Habakkuk is really simple. In chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, he asks a question of God. In chapter 1, 5 through 11, God answers. In chapter 1, 12 through 2:1, Habakkuk asks a second question. And then in chapter 2, God answers the second question. And in chapter 3, Habakkuk responds to the whole experience. So it's going to take us 3 weeks to get through this. I'm dividing the text just by that order. Habakkuk's question, God's answer, and then Habakkuk's question, and I'll leave you on a cliffhanger. You won't know what God's answer is until next time. So let's get into the text of chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. You can maybe tell why some people have been uncomfortable with statements like, why do you idly look at wrong? But we have to start with verse 2 here. O Lord, how long? Habakkuk seems to have been praying for a while, and his answer has been God's silence. And you know, Habakkuk's not the only one to have asked that question, Lord, how long? We find that echoed in Job, the man who lost everything. We find it echoed through the Psalms with David constantly asking, Lord, how long will I suffer like this? How long will this be the way the world works? But the church has been asking this too. When we see crises and when we see the world out of order and nations attacking and violence in the streets and we see unjust judges in courts and we see the world just simply not functioning like a good God should have ordered it, we say, how long, O Lord, will this be the way things are? I think we also say this to God privately when we get diagnoses we don't like, or when we find ourselves weaker than we wanted to be, or when we find the situation around us to be violent or harsh or critical or difficult to deal with. We say, Lord, how long will the things of this world be wrong when they should be right? When will you make these things right? And so personally, I don't know about you, but I'm already on Habakkuk's side. I don't find him being impertinent. I find him being relevant. I ask this question myself, how long, O Lord? But what is it that he is complaining about? He says, I cry to you violence and you will not save. Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. The law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. Well, what he's describing matches perfectly with the time period we think he's in. Most scholars are going to say that he is preaching during the time of a king named Jehoiakim, who is the second to last before the exile. And Jehoiakim, we're told in 2 Kings, shed much innocent blood. And we know the name of one of those innocent people that he killed, and that is the prophet Shemaiah, who is a companion of Jeremiah. Jeremiah, he attempts to assassinate, and he fails. And so we see this king that Habakkuk's looking at, and he's killed the prophets of God. He's killed others. He is violent. People who should not be dying are dying. But it's not even just that. Look at the word strife and contention. In our language, those are not really legal terms, but in Hebrew they are. And then it's paired with the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. Why does the justice never go forth? Because the wicked surround or outnumber the righteous. So the picture that Habakkuk has when he looks out on Judah, on the southern kingdom, is everything is out of order, sin is rampant, cruelty is rampant, and the only hope we have, which is that the law of God would be applied to our hearts by judges and courts and elders, that hope has been dashed. Because the law tells them what they ought to do, but it has to be carried out by human hands. And there's too many wicked people and too little righteous people. And it feels like God's law won't go forth. He looks at a world where it feels like violence is in the streets and it feels like the courts are unjust. And in the wake of that, he prays and it feels like God's silent. It feels like God is not responding. It feels like maybe God doesn't care. And so what we have to pick up with is ask ourselves, well, what should we do in light of this? What should we do when it seems like things are out of order and God doesn't seem to be answering our prayers and we don't have this clear sense of God's purpose and plan in the world and we look out and we feel puzzled or perplexed? or frustrated? Well, I want to go back to those two people I mentioned, Jerome, who says, Habakkuk is impertinent. Why would you ever question God? God is just. Don't you know that? And we would go to Calvin, who says, I understand that he was suffering. It makes sense. But really, you shouldn't talk to God that way. And I'd like to challenge you that what Habakkuk is doing here is he is seeking out the appropriate authority for what is happening. Who else should Habakkuk reach out to? Who else could answer questions like, why does the law go out crooked? What Habakkuk is doing is he's pleading to the one who he believes is in charge. If Habakkuk doubted that God was good, he would never ask these questions. I'm going to encourage you that some people are going to teach that Habakkuk, the book, sees Habakkuk the prophet moving from fear to faith. And I think that is a woefully misunderstood way of viewing this book. I'm going to challenge you to see that the entire book is faith from start to finish. That it is faithful. It is a faithful expression of love and devotion to God to question and ask him why the world isn't working like it should. And it is a faithful and devoted way of living to accept the way it is. We're going to find acceptance at the end. We're going to find questions at the beginning. And I'm going to suggest that if you want to be faithful in your relationship to God, you have to get comfortable with both. You have to be comfortable saying, Lord, I don't understand. How long is it going to be like this? This doesn't seem right. I know you're a good God. I know that you made this world to be good. It doesn't seem right. And then you also have to be comfortable with Habakkuk 3, where he says, regardless of situation and circumstance, you are the strength in my body. You are the joy of my heart. I don't think that previous interpreters are right to criticize Habakkuk. I think that this is how a faithful person responds to a hard world. If you want evidence of this, Habakkuk seems to be doing exactly what Jesus has in mind in Luke 18. An interesting parable, not always a favorite. There's an unjust judge, and there's a woman who's been offended. She's had a slight against her. There is something unjust in her life, and she goes to this unjust judge, and she says, give me justice. And he says, no, because he's unjust. That's the whole point, right? He does not have any interest in doing what he ought. And then she asks again, and he says no. And then she asks again, and he says no. And then she asks again, and he says no. And then eventually she asks him so many times that he says, fine, I will give you justice. And Jesus says, do you think God is unjust that he would be slow to give justice to his people? And then Jesus ends that parable with something very interesting. He ends the parable by saying, the real question is when God looks at the earth, will he find faith? The question is not whether God is willing to answer prayers. The question is whether his people are going to give up when they face the difficult, or they're going to press forward in prayer. I think Habakkuk's doing that. So we've talked about God's silence, and we've heard Habakkuk's plea, which is, God, how can you not do anything about this? Judah is in shambles. What is God's answer? Let's move on to verses 5 through 11. Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swift to devour. They all came for violence, all their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep up like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. God's answer is not what we expect. If you've ever read the book of Job, then you maybe were prepared for that. That when we question and we ask the Lord, we might not get an answer we expect. but I want to take some note on things. Habakkuk's claim that it feels like God is inactive because he's silent is wrong. Now, he was silent. Habakkuk didn't know what was going on. It felt like God wasn't doing anything. God's answer isn't, well, I was talking to you and you weren't listening. His answer was, while I was silent, I was working. Look among the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded. I am doing a work in your days. Now, what's amazing about this is the scope of God's plan. So God's answer essentially to Habakkuk wondering why is the world working the way it is I have a plan, I'm at work, but something to note is how large of a plan it is. Look at the scope. I am raising up the Chaldeans. If you know your ancient history, that's a big thing. What God is essentially saying is that the seed I planted in Genesis 5 with the founding of a city named Babel, that is growing through the Tower of Babel, that is going on even to when Job, at the time of Abraham, loses his flocks to the Chaldeans, which is growing all the way up until Babylon is a small nation that is conquered by Assyria, all the way past that when Assyria gets weak and Babylon gets strong, all the way to the raising up of a king named Nebuchadnezzar, God is at work in all of that in response to the question Habakkuk asks. The scope is far beyond anything Habakkuk could have ever expected. It reminds me of John 9, where the disciples see a man born blind and they say, oh, whose sin caused this man to be born blind? And Jesus says, it wasn't for sin, it was that I might show you my glory. That blind man went his entire life, and do you think for any moment he thought, well, one day the Son of God will walk right in front of me, and his disciples will ask a question, and he'll get to teach them and show them his glory in healing me. No, that's beyond the scope of what he could have ever imagined. Think about Esther. Esther marries the Persian king. There's a plot that she's not aware of to kill the Jews. She finds out about it. God has raised up Mordecai, her cousin, or uncle. Uncle, thank you. Uncle, and Mordecai has now had a place of respect with the king, and it all comes ahead in Esther 4, where Esther, who really has been unaware of most of these dealings, Mordecai tells her, you were made for a time such as this. All of the things that seemed random and unrelated and simply falling to places all within the scope of a great and larger plan. Church, let me suggest something to you. The silence of God might be millions of gears moving in conjunction to do his plan, which is good for you. God might not tell you what's going on. A lot of times he doesn't. But there might be, and millions is an underestimation. There might be trillions of gears throughout this entire world all moving together for his plan for you in the suffering. And that's what God tells Habakkuk. I've been at work in this tiny little city called Babel since Genesis 5, and in Habakkuk chapter 1, it's coming to fruition. Another thing we want to notice is that sometimes God's answer is not what we want it to be. Do you imagine that Habakkuk complaining to God about an unjust city wants exile and death? Probably not. But it's not his answer, it's the Lord's answer. Sometimes our silence gets answered with an answer we didn't want. Paul has a thorn in his flesh. Some people argue that it's a physical ailment, maybe malaria, maybe blindness. Some argue that it's temptation or sin. Some argue that it's something beyond what we understand. Regardless of what it is, Paul prays, Lord, remove it from me 3 times. And God's answer is, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. That's probably not the answer Paul wanted, but it was the good answer. It was the right answer. Let's look at why this would have been such a challenging thing for Habakkuk. the description of Babylon, which hopefully you've caught on, Babylon and Chaldeans are the same group. The description is kind of terrifying. They seized dwellings not their own. This refers to the fact that Babylon, once it got power and freedom from Assyria, began to devour the landscape of the ancient Near East. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their horses are swifter than leopards and fiercer than the evening wolves. They are moving fast. They are taking land at a breakneck speed. They take captives like sand. We might even see in that a little bit of a hint of the Abrahamic promise. God said that he would make Israel like the sands of the shore. You will have that many people. And what does Babylon gather? Captives like sand. When they look at a mighty king who's great at strategy, they laugh. When they see a fortress that could defend against the greatest armies, they mock. They are not afraid. They devour. They are like a wildfire. I like the description in Joel. They, before them is the Garden of Eden, and behind them is a burned wasteland. That is Babylon. And so, certainly this is not what Habakkuk wants. In fact, it really seems strange when it ends with they're guilty and they are idolatrous, worshiping themselves. We're going to find that that is Habakkuk's second question, is how can you use a nation like that? But I want to stop for a moment and recognize a truth that you know. But it's one of the hardest truths to accept, and so it's one that we have to keep telling ourselves. I have to keep preaching it or I will forget it. And that is that God works evil for good. How could sending Babylon be good? It's part of the plan of God to bring about the Messiah, to humble Israel, and to bring about redemption history. We think about people like Joseph, whose brothers pushed him into a well and then sold him into slavery. And then he tried to be righteous in the slave owner's house, and he gets sent to a prison. And then he tries to be righteous in telling some dreams, and the guy who gets released forgets him. And then finally, he is now second in all of Egypt, and he's able to provide so that the entire area doesn't die and that the family line of Abraham doesn't die. We might think of King Cyrus. He's not necessarily a godly man, and yet he takes power in Persia, and one of his first acts is to send the Israelites back to their land to build their temple. We might think ultimately of Pilate. Pontius Pilate condemned the Son of God to death, and because of his evil, I can be with the Lord forever when I die. I mean, let that weight sink into you. Because of Pilate's wicked evil, you are covered in the blood of Jesus Christ, and everything that you have gained from that came out of the evil of Pilate and Herod and the Sadducees and the Sanhedrin. God has surely worked evil for good for us. And so what do we do when we look at a world where God seems silent and things seem out of order? Well, we trust that he has a plan. And I think we say what Paul does in Romans 11, how unsearchable are his paths and how inscrutable are his ways. Who knows the mind of our God? Who has given counsel to him? Who has given him a gift that we might repay? Or we could say what God says of himself, my ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. We have one last section to cover today. We're going to cover it pretty quickly, and that is Habakkuk's response. We talked about the silence of God. We moved on to God's answer, which really highlighted the sovereignty of God. I couldn't work out another S word. That's why I'm an EFCA pastor, not a Baptist pastor. I just don't have the alliteration skills. So you're going to have to forgive me and ignore the word, the letters I-N, okay? Inscrutable. The inscrutability of God, which refers to, if you don't have a dictionary in front of you, the way that we can't fully understand our God because he is so much above us and greater than us. Habakkuk has a second complaint for the Lord. Let's read it in chapter 1, verse 12. Are you not from everlasting? O Lord, my God, my Holy One, we shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings them all up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet. So he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. Habakkuk has a question. It's what we said before. How can you use wicked Babylon? In fact, he makes an implication here, and you look in verse 13, how can you remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? Habakkuk says, this doesn't make any sense. How can you use a nation worse than us to punish us? How can you be on the side of a nation that is evil? In fact, he goes farther in a very interesting poetic sequence. He uses and takes a bunch of language from creation. Right? We hear the fish of the sea, the crawling things. This is all in verse 14. You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. And then he brings them all up with a hook. The picture Habakkuk seems to be going for is if you look all the way back in Genesis 1 and 2, Adam was meant to have dominion over all of creation. And he fell and he sinned. Psalm 8 looks forward to another man who will take true dominion over creation, a new Adam. We love using that term, new Adam. Romans uses it. Habakkuk takes a moment and says, it kind of feels like Babylon is the one who has dominion over all of creation, and he is abusive to his creation. He is destroying what you've made, God. You have made all of these nations, and he devours them all. Why does it feel like he's winning? And the second question, verse 17, is he then to keep on emptying his net forever and mercilessly killing nations forever? The second question Habakkuk asks about this is, if God is using Babylon, where does it end? Will the wicked ever be punished? And if you want an answer to that, you'll have to come by when I preach on Habakkuk chapter 2. But I have two things I want us to note in this. Two things that transform Habakkuk's, let's use Jerome's word, impertinent, rude questions into something incredibly faithful. It happens at the very beginning of what we read and at the very end. Notice the language Habakkuk uses for God. You are from everlasting. He's learned his lesson. God is on a scope way beyond him. O Lord, my God, my Holy One, we shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as judgment. You, O rock, have established them for reproof. What Habakkuk uses as the foundation of his complaint is a recognition of how good, righteous, holy, powerful, and wise God is. It is him making a complaint to the appropriate person. This is the God of the universe who orders all things. When things seem out of order, he's who I ask, is essentially what Habakkuk is saying. He is putting trust in the goodness of God. You guys know by now, because I never stop talking about it, I love the Chronicles of Narnia, and I love C.S. Lewis. And in the Chronicles of Narnia, there's this amazing line where the Pevensey children find out for the first time that Aslan is a lion. They've heard this Aslan, and he seems like a good guy, and they find out, oh, no, he's a lion. And the littlest one goes, he's a lion? Is he a tame lion? And the talking beaver, because it's Narnia, talking beaver says to her, no, Aslan's not tame, but he's good. And if that doesn't sum up how Habakkuk is treating God, I don't know what does. He recognizes, God, things are beyond my control and I don't understand the full picture, and you are not acting as I would have acted. But you're my God, and I know you're holy, and I know you're my rock, and I know you'll use this wisely. The second thing I want us to notice is in chapter 2, verse 1. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. I think some people get very frightened about Habakkuk, as I've mentioned multiple times, because it seems like Habakkuk is asking some harsh questions of God and maybe doubting God. And let me tell you the difference between doubt and this kind of questioning is that Habakkuk waits for an answer. He wouldn't do that if he assumed that God was actually evil, or that God wasn't in control, or that God didn't have his best interests at heart. Habakkuk only would do this if he believes this is a God who has an answer for me. This is a God who has done nothing wrong. Habakkuk questions God in a way that Job, halfway through the book, doesn't. Job demands that God prove that he hasn't done anything wrong, because Job is confident he hasn't done anything wrong. God is going to rebuke Job for the way he spoke. Habakkuk doesn't do this. He has questions, he's puzzled, he doesn't understand, and he's frustrated. He's afraid. But he rests in the knowledge that there is in fact an answer, and God has in fact done well. And so as we wrap this up, let me just encourage you, when we look at a text like this, I hope it gives you license to be more honest in your prayers. I really do. I hope that you will stop feeling like you have to avoid questions you have. I love, somebody once told me, God is big enough to handle your questions. He is not afraid of your puny questions and fears, right? He's a big God. He's not going to be insecure about it. And so I would want to encourage you, without rudeness, without impertinence, but like Habakkuk does, to be honest with God in your prayers, knowing that he does have an answer. It may not be the answer you want, and maybe he won't give you a clear answer like you'd wish, but he is at work in this world, and he is doing right, and he will work out all evil for good. And so we can confidently say, Lord, how long and why?